Although Peter Carey is Australia's best-known contemporary writer, he's lived in New York for the past 20 years, and for much of that time, he's talked about setting a work in his adopted homeland. So I'm pleased to say, as the title suggests, his latest novel, Parrot and Olivier in America, is set largely in America, and it tells the story of two men, one French, one English, who travel together to study the prison system in this country, but who end up instead exploring the relatively young democracy in America, much like Alexis de Tocqueville did in the 1830s. Peter Carey has won the Booker Prize twice for his novels Oscar and Lucinda and The True History of the Kelly Gang. Parrot and Olivier in America is published by Knopf. I'm very pleased that it brings him back to our show today. Hi.
Hi, Lenny.
So we are introduced first to Olivier. Who is he?
Well, he's the child of two survivors of the Terror, which is one of the insights I thought I had when I started to build the character that you don't find in the Tocqueville books, who he's sort of slightly based on. But, you know, the mother and the father were about to be executed when Robespierre was taken away. And the father's hair had turned white overnight. The mother was sick forever. Their family had been guillotined. And so when you start to think about this little boy growing up in this chateau, and with this maybe in my book kept as a secret from him, you do begin to imagine a very particular child.
But he's growing up in a time of a lot of revolutionary ferment. We have the French Revolution, then the Terror, then we have Napoleon, and then we have the return of the monarchy, and then we have another rebellion, and then we have going all the way into 1848, the Paris Commune. He's coming out of a wild time, a time that I guess is not good to be a nobleman.
Well, yeah, and I think at a time too when many aristocrats and monarchists were desperately trying to turn back the great tide of democracy, and the one thing about him is he recognizes that this actually is unstoppable, and my character and Alexis de Tocqueville, really, when they come to America, they're looking at democracy and thinking, what's this going to do to me? What is my future? What can I do?
But probably also, why did it work differently here than it did in our revolution?
Yeah.
Parrot is very different. He's a printer's devil. Is that another way of saying an apprentice?
Yeah, the printer's dead. The printer's devil is, I think, perhaps always called the devil because he's the one that does the lowly jobs. It's pretty more lowly than an apprentice. He's covered in ink all the time, cleaning the equipment and so on.
And he, although he's been a servant all of his life, more or less, he is educated. He can write. He's a trained engraver and artist. So I guess you're also saying that genius knows no class.
Well, I guess the book really contains sort of a number of arguments about democracy and its ups and its downs, and also about art and the making of art, where the aristocrat would think that someone like Parrot couldn't possibly ever make art, and that this is really the occupation of the aristocratic class, or at least to appreciate its subtleties. When the author of this book, that's me, comes from a country that began with a penal colony. And the one thing about my historical experience is that we can be anyone. So there's one thread of argument in the book that says we can be anyone, and that's really sort of Parrot's life and whatever. And then there's Olivier's line of argument, which is different. And the two arguments, and there are many different arguments about democracy and art and so on, as in life, are actually not resolved, but sort of hang there in vibrating opposition, I hope.
Well, they haven't been resolved in this country. We'd like to believe that anyone can become president of the United States, but the fact of the matter, except with a few rare exceptions, the current president being one of them, most of our presidents have been born into wealth.
Well, you know, sometimes one of the things that I thought when I was writing this book and I was thinking about this very thing, the very notion that anyone can be president can occasionally be terrifying. And if I'm looking at Sarah Palin and her supporters, I'm really scared. And I think one of the things, I mean, my American friends who grew up on Tocqueville and studied Tocqueville at college and at school only read bits of it. and very few of them read all of it. So that Tocqueville's fear, you can feel Tocqueville fearing Palin.
Well, we tend to think that it was a totally positive view of America, but you you say if you read the whole book, you'll realize that Tocqueville had mixed feelings.
Yeah, you guys read the good bits.
We read the parts that patted us on the back. Yeah. So do you see parallels between your views and his? As an outsider who came here and who spent a lot more time in this country than he did.
Well, the things that I recognized, particularly reading it during the political period and the cultural period of the last, 4 years, I found that he was worried about things that I was also always worried about. And one of them was a great dumbing down of culture in a democracy. And the other is his fear of the tyranny of the majority, which I've always thought of as the most reactionary fear. You know, if you're Australian, you are the majority. You know, we are against people talking about the tyranny of the majority. But as I saw what he was talking about, I would have said to him, you've got it all wrong, sir, because this majority is not like the mob. This is a population that's an electorate. It is educated. And I think for democracy to really function, obviously, you need an educated electorate, and we actually don't have one.
Well, Tocqueville, as you point out, felt that people in America didn't value art, but you used to complain when you were in Australia that your countrymen didn't value art. And I always wonder about this link between democracy and values. After all, America became the center of artistic activity after World War II in literature, the visual arts, music, and that in contrast with what happened in the 20th century dictatorship, Stalin, Hitler, and Mao insisted that art be understandable to everyone. Communists accused the U.S. of artistic elitism.
Yeah, I wasn't taking this position.
I think this is something that is kind of interesting when you look at the way people have viewed democracy and populism.
Well, there are two different... Yeah, nothing is ever simple, is it? I mean, we do have, if we want to look at what culture is, we do have a great marketing-driven sort of popular culture. And there is many ways that I could wake up in the morning and look around and think, culturally, I'm swimming in a sea of crap. So that is part of the truth. It's also part of the truth, of course, that in democracies, great artists have flourished and flowed, and you know, of whom we're continually excited. And you think of music and art in this country and how vital it is and how it's vital for the whole world. But that doesn't stop the argument existing. I mean, what are we going to value in a mercantile society or, let's say, a capitalist democracy, where the book that you write inevitably is a product? These are things for us to be concerned. And also in a democracy where, even though everybody's functionally literate, people really are not reading anymore. And we have come to sort of accept that that's okay. You know, like it's a hole in the ozone layer and there's nothing we can do about it. But there are if we decided this was threatening to our safety as a nation and as a people, surely we would do something about it.
But people are reading. I see them reading on the subway. They're often not reading books that you would think were great literature.
Well, that's my point.
Yeah, but if I look through the history of art, whether it's the Italian Renaissance or what went on in Holland at the time of Rembrandt and Vermeer, most of the art that was produced was bad art. There were only a few geniuses, and they were appreciated by small group of admirers. Mm. So how is this any different? As long as people are reading, isn't that a good thing?
Well, it was the United...
Or do they all have to read your books, Peter?
Well, they do. That's essential. And come to hear me at the New York Public Library this evening, Lenny. But it is the United States, right? Mm-hmm. No one thinks the United States is the same as what came before. The United States is this huge radical revolution. So surely things can be different in the United States. Can't we hope for more from the people? Can't we hope for more from the democracy? Can't we hope for more from education?
Is that what you would do?
Read?
Is that what you were hoping for when you moved here? I mean, you've been here for 20 years now. By now, I would think that you're pretty much as much an American as you are an Australian, except for that accent.
What's the matter with that? You've got an accent. You've got a very funny accent.
I do. But you know what I mean. At this point, you're no longer the outsider who is looking on what's going on with a certain bemusement.
No, I'm very tangled up in it. And I mean, I think one of the great pleasures of writing this book for me was to find a sort of an engagement with where I was living, and that it could be hugely affectionate, and also, like you do when it's your home, also be critical. So you have both of these things. No, I think it's a very engaged book in that respect.
Peter Carey's latest book is Parrot and Olivier in America. It's published by Knopf, and obviously this is de Tocqueville got you thinking about the current situation. There are other things that you obviously were thinking about. Parrot's girlfriend, a portrait painter who comes with him from France, is able to buy a house in New York even though she has no money. Mm. And Parrot worries about debtors' prison and foreclosure. I'm assuming you were writing that just as the housing bubble was bursting.
Yeah, there's sometimes when you're sort of lucky, though. I mean, I realized that I'd been lucky as I got further into the book and the bubble started to go. I'd begun with a more pragmatic thing. I'm thinking, how's this woman going to get money in New York? Oh, she's going to burn down houses. Well, how's she going to do that? And I figured it out, and I found a banker who was just perfect for our present age.
At one point, Olivier spots a man walking toward him in New York, and he describes him as an emblem of America. He says, I thought this was the worst version of democracy, illiterate, hard as wood, overdressed, uncultured. And he goes on to say, to see the visage of their presidents is to understand that the farmer and the mechanic are the lords of the new world. Public opinion is their opinion. The public will is their will. And then he realizes that this man is Parrot, his own servant. Yeah. Do you think that Parrot is more suited to life in America because he's adopted its ideals? He was born in England. He lived in Australia for a while. He kind of knows how to assimilate.
Yeah, he does. He's a survivor. But he's also, as you read the book, Parrot is the one who has what you would call the American success story. But we leave him at a moment in history where he really is, in a minute, a great financial crash is going to occur. In fact, the last words in the book are the date of that crash. So if you Google it, you'll see what happened.
Well, in this country.
Sorry?
There have been crashes throughout our history.
Well, throughout the world's history, too, generally. But at the end, there's Parrot sort of patronizing Olivier about how wrong Olivier is about things. And we would tend to think he might be right. But we can see it he says there will be no tyrants, there will be no da-da-da. And if you read that at a time when we've been living through what is almost tyranny and on the verge of something worse, then you might see that Olivier had a point.
You switch narrators throughout, going back and forth between these two characters, because these are the two sides of your argument?
Yes. I think that the beginning the book sort of gets conceived. I thought about it in this way as an argument about democracy in which the two arguments would coexist together and not be resolved. So you have to have... So it's very easy to think, okay, I've got to have a French aristocrat. It's a lot harder, of course, to then begin to write the little beast. And then Parrot will represent the other side, yeah.
Now, we've talked earlier about the response throughout the world to the true history of the Kelly Gang, even in Australia, where people assume that you'd done a lot of research and that it was all historically accurate. Much of it was made up, you have admitted. What about here? How much of 1830s America is accurate?
I did vast amounts of America. I was thinking about Paris, France, which was the hard one. Yeah, I think it's pretty accurate. Mm-hmm. I think I would normally wish... I wouldn't wish to argue with what is definitely known, because that sort of alienates you from your readers who do know. But in certain cases, talking about truth and untruth, I spent an awful lot of time researching a chateau where Tocqueville had lived, and I had a French architectural historian, and we worked for months just trying to imagine where he would live. And when I understood it, I sort of changed it all. So in other words, I did the work to know where I was, and then I invented something that was true, but was true for my character and the book.
We talked before you came here with somebody who believes that what makes for what we call genius is really just a lot of work, hard work. Is that what you tell your students at Hunter College?
I do tell them it's the number of hours you spend and the amount of will you have is more important, really, than talent. I knew when I was younger, people were much more talented than I was, but I was an obsessive fool, and I worked and worked and worked and worked. And so I think you've got to spend the hours writing and reading, of course.
Mm. And I'm assuming you're working on another novel already?
Oh, but of course.
Will it take place here, or are you going back to Australia?
No, I'm not doing neither one of those things. I'm led by ideas, really. In the end, the idea forces you to go somewhere. So this is, it's set in, there's a woman, an English woman in London in the present period, and there's a man, an English, slightly posh fellow in Germany in about 1861.
You've written so often about the past. Why is that?
Well, I am always thinking about if we want to know where we are, we will only know by looking at the past. And that's really, I always find it very exciting when you read something and you see in the past our presence predicted.
Peter Carey will be speaking with the writers Edmund White and Claire Massoud tonight at 7 o'clock at the New York Public Library on 5th Avenue and 42nd Street. For tickets, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. And the book, which has gotten terrific reviews. I don't know whether there's ever been a three-time Booker winner. Has there?
No. I'm happy with two.
A two is enough? Okay. Well, perhaps there still will be a three, although Salman Rushdie was here when he was the favorite for the Booker last year, and he said, please do not say anything about it because that is bad luck, and sure enough, he didn't win.
Of course, Salman.
Parrot and Olivier in America is published by Knopf. I'm sorry, I hope I didn't put the kibosh on you.
Ha, ha, ha.